I'm just waiting for the lorry to go by. It's not bin day, hurry up.
Tide is high and we're moving on.
It's talking time.
Who's gonna be your number one?
Here comes the time.
We're not the kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello and welcome to Today in Digital Education, episode 105. This is a podcast with me, Di Barnes.
And me, Doug Welshaw. Di, it sounds like you're not at home.
I am not at home. I am in Idaho. It is my own private Idaho today, and it is glorious 40 degrees centigrade.
Wow, so 40 degrees. It's been about 30 here, and I've been kind of melting.
Yeah, so it's, well, obviously there's air conditioning here, so it's quite nice for some people. My friend, so I'm staying with friends of mine, Laurie and Gilbert, Laurie and Gilly, and so I'm sitting on their front porch in the shade, but they have air conditioning, which is lovely. So the day splits up around the heat of the day, which is about 2 o'clock till 6 o'clock. Really, it's really hot. So you kind of plan your activities around that. The mornings are beautiful, the evenings are beautiful, and the midday sun is only good if you're on the water somewhere.
Are you having siestas?
Yeah, I do actually. So I kind of keep they're at work and I'm just staying with them for a month. And I kind of keep their work schedule. So I get up with them and go to bed with them, not with them as such, at the same time. And I fit a nice little little nap in the afternoons, which is great. Where are you?
I'm back home, but as we communicated last week, I was on the other side of the mountains to you. I was in Montana, in Helena, Montana. So if we'd organized a bit more, we could have met up, I think, and maybe done a fully American Tide, but I was in on the Monday last week, so that we're recording this on Tuesday, the 25th of July, 2018. I was there last week, flew in on the Monday, three flights, Newcastle, Amsterdam, Minneapolis, and then Minneapolis, Helena. And then I was there Tuesday, kind of decompressing. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday was the mountain moot, which is kind of a Moodle moot, which is not run by HQ. Which was great. And then I flew back on the Friday overnight and got back to England on the Saturday. And the hilarious thing, Di, was everything went smooth as butter. So I flew on the way back, I flew Helena to Salt Lake City and saw all those amazing kind of salt pans around the lake, all different colors and everything like that. And I slept really well on the flight over to Amsterdam. And then we get off the plane at Newcastle after everything being on time. And there's a queue going into the airport, which I've never seen before, getting into the airport doors. And it was because there was no one there in Newcastle Airport to unlock the doors. We had to stand there for 10 minutes.
Such fun.
Never mind. So how long are you in Idaho for?
So I'm doing a month, the middle of July to the middle of August. And not doing anything special, but I've been doing some great things. I found this hot yoga place, which sounds a bit ironic doing hot yoga, and I'm already in a hot yoga place. But it's really good. So most mornings I go and do 90 minutes of hot yoga, which is great. And they had this great deal of 20 days for $20. So I don't really have to pay for it. I do as much yoga as I like in that time. And so I do that. I go there on a bicycle, which is cool. Not very many bicycles around in America, or in Idaho, or in Boise. I'm in Boise, just at the foothills of whatever. And it's really cool. So it's a really upcoming place. A lot of Californians are moving here, apparently. So Gil and Laurie have been in this house about a year and a half, and it's already gone up 25% in its value. Wow. And because so many people are moving here. It's a really, really lovely town. It has different kind of vibes going on about it. It's really cool. So on Saturday, we were out busking. So Laurie plays banjo in a band. So the band were out busking at the farmer's market, which was really cool, really well received. It made $150, kind of thing. It's really good. And what else have I been doing? I've been rafting on the river a couple of times, which is amazing. So you go, you organize cars, and this is just with friends. It's not like through an organization. station. So Laurie's sister does this. So you go on either on a kayak by yourself or a couple of you on a kayak, or you go on a big raft, which is just a big dinghy really with a structure inside it. And you row up and down, you just row downstream and you go through the white water. And my gosh, this is such a beautiful place. So you're drifting through the mountains on this river, and it's just fir trees, whatever, either side of you on the mountains going up and up and up. So beautiful. Went up to Wallowa Lake as well, because I went up to La Grande. So my cousin lives 3 hours up the road. Coincidentally, Laurie grew up 2 minutes from her house. So they live in the same town, you know, it's a bit weird. Wow. And she has four kids, who I saw 4 or 5 years ago. And so it's nice to catch up with all of them. And we went up to a lower lake and saw a couple of bald eagles and two of their fledglings learning how to fly, which was really, really exciting. Again, just more canoeing on the river and that kind of thing.
Cool. You put in the show notes that you've been in the Lake District as well. So you've been pretty outdoorsy.
Since the last time, so we last spoke properly in the middle of June. So since then, I had the last week of term, which was the last week of June, I was doing Gold TV in the Lake District, and it was beautiful, beautiful weather, sort of about 25 to 28.
So just for the benefit of those who might be in America or somewhere else who don't know DOE, Duke of Edinburgh, how would you describe that?
So it's the Duke of Edinburgh Award. You get do bronze, silver, and gold, and part of it is an expedition. So in gold, it's 4 days, 8 hours journey time each day, and camping out overnight, wild camping possibly. And there's other things as well, like social and contributions and things like that you have to go and do for a year.
Right.
Contribute towards this Duke of Edinburgh Award. So we did this. We did the practice one. I think I talked about it a few months ago. In April, and down in Dartmoor, where it was all wet and cold and miserable. This one was in the glorious sunshine. The children had to cope with the heat and walking in the heat with a big pack on and all of that, which they did admirably. But for us teachers, it was kind of hands-off because it's the assessed version. So there's like three assessors we had as well, because we had quite a big group of 48 students, I think. And so these three assessors do most of the donkey work. And so I was swimming in Lake Ullswater, which was the most beautiful thing, with all these beautiful big green hills around me and the golden sunshine and mill pond on Ullswater. It was just beautiful swimming out to the islands there. So I've been having a bit of an active time. It's been really, really quite awesome in between the Lake District and Idaho, yeah, and Oregon too.
The question, the $64,000 question everyone's asking is, are you doing all of this barefoot?
Of course, yes. So it gets a bit hot. So I've been doing lots of running as well. Not lots of running. I've been up two or three or four times up in the foothills. So where Gil and Laurie live is just down the foothills of, I don't know what the hell the mountain range is called, but so it's only a mile from their house. So I run up there and then run up the foothills. But the trails are lovely for your bare feet, to be honest. They're sort of sandy and not too rocky in places. Cool. But my feet can take that sort of thing. And so I have to put shoes on like the tarmac and things like that at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Oh, because it's too hot.
Because it's too hot for me. So if your feet get used to that with more heat on them, so they seal over in a different kind of way. But mine aren't there yet. So there are people who can walk barefoot in through Dubai, for example, outside where it's 50 degrees and blah, blah, blah. But I can't do that.
It'll be like throwing meat on the barbie.
It would be. It would be very much like that. So, so I'm just filling my days doing interesting things like running up in the foothills, and we're going to go camping and stuff like that. I'll go back up to La Grande again and see my cousins before I leave. Mm-hmm.
You put Fitbit in the show notes. Is that because you're now tracking your stuff on a Fitbit?
I am, yes. So the Fitbit I bought for my dad, he never really got into. I guess I should have spent more time with him analyzing the data. He used it for a couple of days and said, yeah, it's great, thanks. So I asked if I could borrow it to see what it's like. And so I put it through its paces just to see what data comes out of it.
Which one is it?
It's the Charge 2. So it has a heart monitor on it.
Oh, that's the one that Hannah, my wife's got.
Oh, okay.
And no, she's got the Alta. She had the Charge 2 and then she got the Alta. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, it's it's waterproof. So I keep it on when I'm in the water. It doesn't identify activities particularly well. I don't do things particularly fast. So it's not really helpful for the Fitbit. It's because it thinks I'm walking when I'm running. And cycling, I don't cycle very fast either, because it's so hot here. So, but that said, what interesting data? Sleep data is quite interesting. Exercise data, step data is sort of quite interesting. Heart rate data is particularly interesting to me at the moment, especially doing all the yoga I'm doing, which is about, you know, you returning your heart rate from extreme exertion in a stretch to, and then relaxing. The name is Svanyasya or whatever, some bollocks, turning it back down low again. But I haven't really, to be honest, what I've come down to, I was having this discussion with a colleague of mine about data and what he wanted to do with data and his ambitions for it. It's just his responsibility in the school. And I was sort of talking about whether the idea of being data driven or not. And the Fitbit's a sort of a little sort of micro picture of this, in that I'm curious that if I start doing things, I'm quite an active person, but I do have sedentary days. And if I start doing things because of my data rather than just because of what my body's telling me and my mind telling me I want to do. So that's what I'm interested in. And at the moment, I don't think I care to know all of this information. It's quite interesting.
Well, it's interesting because, so I'm wearing my Huami Amazfit Bip watch, which I got for £45, if you remember, from Hong Kong. And it's great. And it, right now it's telling me I've done 11,676 steps. That's because I foolishly went for a run in the middle of the day. I'll talk about that in a moment. It tells me my distance and my steps and stuff. If I was on like 8,000 steps, I would go for a walk. Like right now. If I was on 4,000 steps, I'd be like, oh, I really must try harder tomorrow, etc. So I think it does kind of give you that little boost sometimes. But then remember last time I told you I'd bought those scales?
The body. Yes, body mass scales.
Like, I've been avoiding those scales because I know what they're going to say. They're going to say that I'm overweight and that I need to do this and that and whatever. So I think it's one of those ones where if you're on a streak and you're doing okay, like you're doing your 10,000 steps or you're doing this or that, it's fine and you want to keep that streak up. I'll tell you a little story about Duolingo in a moment. But if you're not on that, you almost like try and avoid it. It's interesting.
But you see, the thing is that I worry about that. So I don't think I've ever been anything but overweight. And but I was watching some videos when my children were little. So I was putting them off cassette onto digital format onto computer. And I was trim as hell. I couldn't see an inch of fat on me. And I just think I have the wrong body for all of these calculations that they do. I don't know. And I look at everybody else anywhere near my age, and unless they're like skinny lads, which I am not, you know, I'm a stocky built guy. I just think I look pretty well.
I know what you mean.
Like, nothing to write home about.
There are sometimes these things have unrealistically high expectations, but, the story about Duolingo is an interesting one. So I'm just going to go through all the things I've been doing since we last talked. So one of the things was that I was in Barcelona for the Moodle MOOC there, presentation on MoodleNet, which was great. And it made me realize how much I need to learn a different language and that Spanish shouldn't be too hard to learn. And Barcelona is a potential place to move to as well, further down the line. So the day after, or on the day that the Moodle ended, or one of those days, I started learning Spanish on Duolingo. And I thought, I'm just going to do as much as I possibly can. And so I was just using the free version. And I didn't stop you. In fact, I tell you what I did to motivate myself. I made a club. You can make a club on the mobile app on Duolingo. So I made a club, and I invited people because Martin Dugiamas made this proclamation at the Moodle MOOC that next year he was going to do the keynote in Spanish. Well, we'll see if that materializes. But I made this Moodle club on Duolingo, and loads of people signed up, including one person who's just moved from Australia to Barcelona. Didn't speak a word of Spanish, but she's from Russia and already speaks English and some other languages as well. Anyway, so there I was in Helena, and I was on 17. I was on a 17-day streak, and I was just using the free version of Duolingo. And if you'd asked me then, Di, Doug, would you like to upgrade to Duolingo Plus for £8 a month? I would say no, because the free version's fine. But because I was going backwards in time, I got mixed up about what day it was and whatever, and I missed a day on Duolingo. And the next morning, it went, oh, you've ended your streak. But if you upgrade to Duolingo Plus, you get one free streak repair per month. Would you like to try a 7-day trial? Oh. And of course, at that point, I'm like, yes, of course I would. Just because of the psychology, keeping your streak active.
Yeah.
I canceled that 7-day trial now, but I'm now on like a 20 or 23-day streak or something.
Oh, okay. Well, I think streaks, this is the thing, isn't it? So what's what I found with the Fitbit is that you kind of get into the information. And as you say, it's like what it would tell me is if I'd had several sedentary days, and where I think, because in the holidays, I tend to do stuff like go running and swimming and whatever. I think in the holidays, I mean, in term time, it'll be much more useful when I start to see, oh my God, you've gone a week without doing any exercise, or a week without ever passing 10,000 steps, or do you know what I mean? And so I think it might be useful then, because there are...
Well, I think it's good for correlations. Like when I came back, so you know what it's like when you get jet lagged and you're kind of just out of, you feel like you're out of sync. Like you'll have it when you come back, I'm sure. And you know, you do all the things that you're supposed to do, etc. I found the best thing to do is to just treat every day as though you're making sure that tomorrow is not going to be a bad day when you've got jet lag. And for me, the Fitbit or whatever it is you use to track your stuff is a way of knowing what it is that you should do every day to make sure that tomorrow you don't feel crap.
Yes, I think that's a fair thing. So, but my body, I was reading an interesting article. Can we go there? Have you, I don't know if you put it in this, you know, the one you've put in your thought shrapnel about eating.
Oh yeah. Cause I've only just put that in. Yeah.
Let's put it in now. And, because I was reading it this morning and thinking, because I'm in this hot climate and then in air conditioning, then I go into yoga where I sweat. It's so, honestly, it's so funny in yoga. So I'm there in my swimming trunks because I need full flexibility and no material, and everything gets super wet. And I start sweating before everyone else, I think. And then as soon as my head goes down for the first time, I see the drips of sweat going onto my towel underneath me, a special sort of yoga towel. And then we go whatever pose we get to, and spreading my legs apart and then bending at the middle and putting my head to the floor. And then I just look back and I see a stream of water coming off my scrotum and then rain pouring from my head.
I'm going to have to mark this podcast as not safe for work.
It's just bizarre, honestly. I sweat so much. So anyway, the point about that, what I'm trying to make is that when I come out, I feel like on a top dollar. But I get back. I got back here today, for example, and I felt a little lightheaded, and I drink so much water while I'm here, and it's really hot. I worry about my system, but you note in your article, you tend to put your calorie eating consumption towards the end of the day, which is exactly what I do as well. I don't eat breakfast. Mm. I tend to rely on
coffee. There's two articles I put here, which I wanted to talk about, actually. The first one is hyponatremia. Hyponatremia, is that right?
Hyponatremia, yes.
Yeah. So, just quickly, because these two go together, I would say. So every time I get a migraine, my wife says, drink more water. And I am already drinking, shed loads of water. You'll never see me without a bottle of water with me, because I just drink constantly because I don't want to get dehydrated. Mm-hmm. I still get headaches and migraines and stuff. And I was reading Tim Ferriss's book, Tools of Titans, which kind of expands on the interviews he's had with people like Arnold Schwarzenegger and, you know, whatever. And I'm always a bit skeptical about Tim Ferriss's book because he does blow his own trumpet a lot, but it's actually extremely useful. And he talks about the dangers of hyponatremia, which is basically having so much water that you dilute the amount of sodium in your body, i.e. salt. And he suggests that you should put a pinch of salt in your water, especially when you're exercising. So I've started putting a pinch of salt and a pinch of sugar. It's a bit like an isotonic drink, isn't it? So I've been doing that when I've been swimming and also after running. And it's made a big difference, actually, because I don't feel like, oh, I'll just have a bit more water to get rid of that headache. And it actually makes things worse.
All right. Okay. Interesting. It's because that is interesting, because I think that's possibly what's going on for me. I drink a lot of water, but I'm not peeing very much. And it's, but I do feel like there's a need of something. So I will, when I first got into running, and I was running like 30 to 50 miles a week, I'd never drink before an hour of running was up, just because my body was using its own resources. But then you get into this, but here I think it's different, and I do feel that maybe that would be useful. And I remember on the Gold Duke of Edinburgh, the students all drank some diarrhoelite every day, which I thought was something to do with diarrhea, but apparently it's not. It's to do with replenishing your electrolytes.
At the Mozilla conferences, the ones for staff, they used to give out something called Drip Drap, which you put into your bottles, which had that kind of isotonic effect.
Yeah, so it's the isotonic drinks. And I know I had a bottle of Gatorade the other day, and it was just like bliss. That's that sweet and that salt thing in it. And it says it's a thirst quencher, but I don't think it really is. I think it makes you want to drink more, but that's not a bad thing here. I do think I'm going to have to, so a pinch of salt and a pinch of sugar.
Yeah, that's all I'm doing, and it has made a big difference. I mean, it doesn't taste amazing, obviously, but at least you're in control of what's going into it. But the other article, the one you mentioned first, the kind of When We Eat Matters one, I found that really interesting. What's your take on that?
The only thing was is that, say, today, for example, I'm just opening up the link. I decided to eat after going to yoga and before coming to talk to you, and it's perfect. Just I just feel replenished, completely replenished. Just having a cheese omelette, and because I don't eat early in the day, and I do think that's probably a mistake. I sort of depend on coffee and cigarettes. They kind of get me through appetite suppressants, etc., etc. And I'll have lunch when I'm working, but not, I'll usually have a little lunch, much like you said, you have eggs at lunchtime. And that's usually what I have as well. Usually after doing some exercise, some running or whatever. And then I have a big meal in the evening, and it's interesting that that's like ask about face, if you like.
But it's difficult, isn't it? Because if you, like, for me, and so you're living with people who have been at work all day, so obviously they're going to have dinner in the evening. And if you went, oh, actually, no, I'm not eating, that would be seen as antisocial, in the same way that if I don't eat with my family, like, that just seems weird. So yes. It's a difficult thing to do. But the approach, so I've tried to fast before, and because if my blood sugar gets too low, I get migraines, I can't fast. Like, it just doesn't work. I just get migraines constantly. So I did come across this approach called intermittent fasting, which is where you can put your body into ketosis, basically, which means that you're using you're getting the stuff that your brain needs, the glucose for your brain or whatever, from your body supply, which is a good thing to do. And you can do that by having certain foods and by making sure that you eat for a short time period, ideally 4 hours, I think, but like up to 8 hours, and then you're not eating for 16 hours of the day. And apparently that's the best thing to do.
Oh, okay. Well, it's interesting because, yeah. I don't know. It's a difficult thing, but I do look, I mean, what these guys are saying in this article so I don't snack so much, but I do put all of my food towards the end of the day.
Well, maybe that's not such a bad thing. Maybe if you can't control that, or don't want to, maybe just like try and compress that amount of time. So have your lunch later and your dinner earlier. I mean, there's loads of things I do that I've heard advice that you shouldn't. Like, for example, blend fruit. Apparently, you should blend vegetables, but not blend fruit.
Is that right?
Yeah, apparently. Okay. But every morning I have two bananas in water with protein powder, which is made of rice protein, pea protein, and hemp protein. I have creatine, because otherwise I don't get enough stuff to produce testosterone because I don't eat meat. And what else do I have? It's a thing to, like, muscle recovery thing. Flaxseed powder. There's also a reason I've been putting inulin in, which is supposed to be good for your gut. And I take like a multivitamin tablet, vitamin D tablet, and what's the other one called? L-theanine, which is good for kind of low-level anxiety, you know, that background existential angst.
Okay. So
literally every day. And then at lunchtime, I always have either like an omelette like you have, often with sriracha sauce, which is spicy, or like scrambled eggs on toast. And then I have a different dinner. So like my breakfast and my lunch every day at home is the same.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. I mean, because I'm my food is dictated to by my during term time by what the school provides, really, because I eat where I need to, if you know what I mean, for work. But it's interesting. It's something I'm going to think about. I've started using Huel quite a lot. I've talked about it before, which is like a food supplement thing, which you make into a shake with water and has all of. It's very well rated on its website. I've not seen it reviewed in any detail. Huel, so Huel with an H rather than fuel, and I find that quite helpful. And so you know, it's sort of a liter of water goes into it, maybe, and three scoops of that, and that's I use that after I've run. That's the drink I have after I've run usually, and. Especially in the hot weather where it takes a lot out of you, the running. Yeah, I miss that being here because I haven't brought any with me.
I'll have a look at that.
It's quite good. And I'd be interested in your take on it because you'll do so much more analysis on it than I do. And you can tell me whether it's worth the bother or not. I'm nearly at the bottom.
Of a blend of oat pea protein, flaxseed, brown rice protein, MCTs, from coconut sunflower oil and bespoke vitamin and mineral blend, vanilla flavor and sweetener. So I'm already having pea protein, flaxseed, brown rice protein, vitamins. So it's only the MCTs. So that's the oil, you know, which is supposed to be.
Yeah. Well, actually, that brings me to another point. I've been reading on the Guardian newspaper while I've been away, a couple of stories about fish oils, about omega-3. Which is a whatever billion-dollar industry or $30 million industry or something.
Well, it's just bollocks.
And that it's all bollocks, yeah. It's quite interesting indeed. Is that they're just coming out and just saying, look, this is all just rubbish, even though we've been talking about it for years. I remember there's been studies in schools where they've been giving them to the children in primary schools, I think it was. We might have talked about it, but it's a couple of years ago. And or longer than that even. Yeah, I don't know.
Did you see that guy who maintains that there's a link between like the MMR vaccine and autism? Do you see that he's like going out with Elle McPherson?
Elle McPherson?
Yeah.
Wow. Elle the Body McPherson.
Indeed. And he's like 61. Good skill.
Oh my gosh. Well, maybe he's got an answer that he didn't tell everyone.
Well, it was interesting, the article in the Eye magazine. It was talking about how he's just got this ability to make especially women feel like they're the center of the universe. And of course, it just magnifies any fears or irrational theories that they might have, because he's just saying, oh, you're right, etc.
Okay.
Yes. Anyway, just quickly going through stuff we've been doing since we last spoke, I just finished that off. Mm-hmm. We had a wonderful We Are Open co-op meetup. It was the first time that Gronje Hamilton was there in person with us, which was great. I ran a workshop for the Carnegie UK Trust. They've got a digital accelerator called Not Without Me, and they're bringing together different kind of charities and trusts and giving them a small amount of money to do kind of like digital skills and digital literacy interventions. And then whoever does the best and pitches the best will get a follow-on funding. So I ran a workshop around digital literacies, which was great in Manchester.
Cool.
I also ran a workshop for the National STEM Learning Centre, which is kind of, it's got MOOCs on future learning, etc. And I met the guy at the OER 18 conference, and I ran a session on like, how would you go beyond just doing your standard online course? How would you make it non-linear? How would you like think differently about it? Which went really well. Scout Camp was good. Although I managed to get a group of 10 girls all stung by pottery wasps, which was interesting.
What? that's well done.
I was tasked with putting together like a treasure hunt, and the you know when you have those takeaway boxes, stuff full of sweets, and they had to navigate a map to find out where these boxes of sweets were, basically. So there were four groups, and I ended up having the group of 10 girls. I'd hidden this box like in a crack of the rock face, which you had to kind of climb up to a bit. And when I put it there, I got stung on my nose and my head, but I thought, oh, just a random wasp. But of course, when we all went up there, they disturbed the wasp nest, and these pottery wasps, which if you are stung enough times by them are poisonous, basically stung all the girls. And so they effectively ran all the way back to camp.
Oh my word.
That was fun.
Well, I'm lucky. Anything you do, anything with sugar, hey?
Wow. what else? Barcelona Moodle Mood, I mentioned. I've kind of soft relaunched a blog that I'd forgotten about in the wake of Thought Shrapnel being more of a blog this year, which is Discourses. And of course, it's been the World Cup. The entirety of the World Cup has happened, Di, since we last spoke.
I know. Wasn't it fun? I was so pleased that England got knocked out in a way because they really weren't good enough to play France.
No.
I didn't think, and I think the Belgium match proved that, and really France-Belgium should have been the final.
Did you watch all the matches?
No, I did not. Sorry, but I watched the final at my cousin's office when I was up there. She wanted to watch it too, and then her internet didn't work. We had to go to somebody else's house, some American people's house, who was watching.
Well, annoyingly, I was at scout camp for the quarterfinal, so I was listening to that on iPlayer Radio. And then the semi-final, I was travelling between Manchester for that workshop I just mentioned and the We Are Open Co-op meeting in London in Brian's house. And so I arrived. It was bizarre. I got off the train onto the tube, and the tubes were just empty for that time of night, like, you know, 6, 7 o'clock, which is unusual. Got to Brian's house just at the start of extra time for the semi-final. And he had it all rigged up with a projector, which was awesome. And then, yeah, managed to watch the finals and stuff. But I love the World Cup. I love it so much. I really do.
It is great, isn't it? And it was interesting how all the non-European teams had gone and all of that. Germany going out was very exciting. It was great. And I think I'm doing a disservice to England. But England should have hung on in that semi-final, I felt.
They're still young.
Well, yeah, but still, you know, it's like, it's not rocket science football, is it? You know what I mean? They're going to come out and pillage you is what's going to happen after halftime. And they did.
Well, indeed. Especially if you score early.
Anyway.
Right. Anything else that we've missed in terms of what you've been up to?
Not that I recall. I've been up to too much. There is something. So after, because we broke up on the 1st of July, with a very lovely Leavers ball, which was great fun. And then, so the next week I was doing some work, and because I'd been away and things like that, I had lots of things to tie up. One of the things I did, we went around all the classrooms in the school looking at the display screens that are available in those classrooms.
Oops.
As we're going to update them into televisions. And I thought it was worth saying that, my department's relocating over the summer to a building that's due to be knocked down in the next few years. So it's a temporary thing, but we're putting these screens up, and I have this pillar. So I'm doing a horseshoe shape around the room. People who use computer classrooms might be interested, or set them up, might be interested in this. Horseshoe shape around the room is 22 workstations, I think. But there's a couple of power pillars dropping from the ceiling to the floor in the middle of the room. And so they're only about sort of, I'd say, 6 inches square. So on one of these pillars, I'm going to put, rather than having one big screen in the room, I'm going to put three screens, two back to back, and then one sitting on top facing away from me. But three smaller screens. So no one computer that the pupils use will be like more than 10 to 15 feet away from the screen. So the screens don't need to be massive. And it was really good. So then we went around the school. Yeah, I think it's a really good idea. I went around the school and just looking at the idea of, rather than having one display, one big display that's in that focal point way, because people will be casting to these displays rather than actually standing in front of a board, you know, the old interactive whiteboard and mimicking the teacher at the front of the room model. You can be anywhere in the classroom, so therefore you can actually decrease the size of the display, so they're much cheaper. So a 50 or 75 inch display rocks in at about just less than £2,000. But a 50-inch display is like 500 quid. So you can be quite creative in that regard for the same money. And so I was looking at that and looking at what would suit different classrooms, trying to work out some ratio of distance to screen size.
Means that you can have different things on different screens as well.
Well, you could do that, yes. So you could split the screens up and extend the monitors, but we would just have them in a mirroring effect in the first instance, because the point being is viewing angle. They're not in a row or anything like that. But it's the sort of thing that you see much more of when you go to universities and places like that. And when we did our design technology center, I did this with, so there's a big screen, but I also did satellite screens because the room's quite large. And that was lots of money being thrown at those projects, but this isn't lots of money. So we're about $2,500 a classroom to get this done.
We've talked about this before. Remember we were talking about wireless slates and stuff back in the day, rather than interactive whiteboards. Like, I'm a big believer in smaller, cheaper stuff like you're doing. The classroom, there was at the Mountain Moot, there was like a big library. It was in a library, so there was a big library space, and then there were kind of classrooms and stuff coming off it. So it's a regular sized classroom that you'd fit like 30 students in potentially. And that had five projectors in.
Five? Wow.
Five projectors, yeah. And whiteboards all the way around as well. And also what they'd done was that classroom was slightly older, I think, than some of the other ones. And all of the rest of them either had that idea paint painted, or it looks like the idea paint people have now got something like instead. So you
can write a car just drove by. Say that again. Now got what? Idea paint people.
Idea paint, you know, when you can just paint on the wall, etc.
Yeah, I know that.
I think idea paint, it looked like, from what I looked at, I didn't ask them about this, but it looked like for some of the walls, they had something which you peeled and then stuck on the wall, which then you could, you know, write on and then rub off.
Oh, okay. So that's like the sort of stuff that we've used before, potentially. Because idea paint is really hard to do properly.
Right.
So that it keeps working is really, really difficult. When I looked at it in detail, it wasn't easy. And that's the thing that my classroom is going to have a shortage of is marker boards. So I'm going to come up with some funky...
Well, I've talked to you about this magic whiteboard stuff before, haven't I?
Yeah, we have this sort of, the adhesive stuff. So you have like the film that just adheres anywhere you like, and it's good for a couple of three uses and stays up for a while. I think it works through static or something. I've used that, and I've used sticky whiteboard stuff as well. But I just don't have any surfaces. That's my problem. There's that lend themselves to it. And when you're working in a horseshoe, so I'm gonna have to work out something quite funky in the middle of the room, I think, on wheels probably.
It sounds like you need a flip chart.
Well, yes, I have one of those in my flat, and so a flip chart would be all right, but then I don't want to. Or maybe that would work, actually. You just take it, you write on it, and stick it on the wall and stop framing that stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know. We'll see what it's like. We're being relocated at minimum budget, so we'll see how that unfolds.
You're being moved to a condemned room.
So, yes, absolutely. But a condemned room with air conditioning, it doesn't work very well, but I've still got it. And beautiful views, actually. So it's I'm quite pleased. Surrounded by trees and stuff. So there's, you look out every window, you've got green. It makes me happy.
I was talking to one of the mothers at Scout Camp, and I can't remember the exact job title she's got, but you know, for example, if you're on a construction site or you've got a factory or there's some kind of project, whatever it is, and things need replacing every so often, there's like compliance around health and safety that has to be adhered to. And it's not like, oh, you have to have a hard hat on to come to this site. It's more like the filter in that thing needs replacing every 6 months, and she's the one who makes sure that happens. And she was talking about one of the schools that my kids go to, that her son goes to as well, and how the kids were coming home with rashes, which seemed to be symptomatic of basically the not air conditioning, but the air circulation system having some kind of fungal growth in it.
Okay.
I wondered to what extent schools in general do that kind of stuff.
Well, I mean, our school is not a typical school, so it's a big private boarding school with, relatively speaking, a lot of money. Mm. And so our air conditioning systems for our server rooms are outsourced. So I wonder if they do that.
Yeah, I should imagine if they're outsourced, usually, like, as part of the contract, you know, they know what they're doing, etc.
Yeah, but we've actually had to sack a company because it didn't do what it was supposed to do, because they hadn't been wrapping in the filters, actually. When they'd done their maintenance, they just signed it off without actually doing the work. So they got sacked anyway.
Well, you have to have people checking the checkers as well, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. All right, so where should we go next? We can either just do this in order, or if there's something that stands out, what would you rather do?
Let's go in order. So Don Norman on human-centered technologies.
Okay, so these are just a few links that I have come across over the time that we've been away. Not everything, obviously. So I still haven't read Don Norman's The Design of Everyday Things, but it's referenced in lots of places, and I really should get around to doing it. And in this article, which appears in Fast Company, he kind of just says, look, we need to switch from this kind of technology-centric view of the world towards a more people-centric one. So we tend to argue that this technology is coming, you're going to be left behind if you don't adopt it, you know, get with the program. Mm-hmm. And this really struck a chord with me, because when I was in Barcelona, the keynote was given by, I have to remember the name, but she used to work at Nesta. She's Italian, and she's now like head of digital strategy at Barcelona City. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And she was talking about how loads of cities are just like basically handing the keys to the city over to like Google and whatever, like we've talked about before. Whereas in Barcelona, what they're trying to do is to find out what citizens actually need and what would make their lives better, and then coming up with a technological solution for that if it's appropriate, which is, of course, the right way of doing things. And this is what Don Norman is talking about in this article.
Well, this is an interesting thing. So I've been saying for years, so people say, head of digital strategy, what's that mean? And I say, so my philosophy, I guess, is that technology is about people, not about machines. Mm. And that's why I'm good at what I do. Because I'm always thinking about the people and not the machines. What is the right thing for the workflow, for the productivity, for the daily routine of the people that are going to be using whatever it is that's available? Is it going to add any value to what we already possess? Is it like, if you would like, or what's
hence the kind of email sabbaticals and stuff that you've, or the phone sabbaticals and stuff?
So it's really trying to think about what it is that people want and need, especially in regards to pastoral care of the pupils. It's about what they need, but never, you know, so I'm very keen on, when I reviewed the digital detox, I don't know if we talked about this when I was...
You said you were about to start it, and then, yeah, obviously we haven't spoken since then.
Oh, okay. So the outshot of that was that we decided for the youngest pupils in the boarding houses, so that's 11-year-olds to 15-year-olds, so up to year 10, they will not, no one gets their phone overnight. They get handed in every night. And then on a Sunday, every other Sunday, up to year 10 will not have their phones back on the Sunday. And the senior members of the boarding houses will be engaged or charged with creating activity on that day to do with the pupils, that just going and playing football or whatever it might be, doing something that's analog and offline. And then the next weekend, they're going to have their phone on a Sunday. And the point being is, because what I want the students to feel is that this is an educative point. It's not a punishment. It's to sort of just to see that they can put their phones down, because when they're away from home and life is very busy, they want to escape very quickly and they go into their devices. And that's not always a bad thing. Like Fortnite, for example.
Oh yeah.
Lots of bad things going on, but I walked past a couple of prep rooms, homework study places in my boarding house. And there's a couple of kids on there playing Fortnite with their phones on to each other in the rooms next door, because they're talking live on their phones whilst they're playing in the same game in Fortnite, so they can back channel it and do all of it. Do you know what I mean? This stuff is just really exciting and just...
No, absolutely. And it reminds me of, because that kind of realization of, you know, instead of just telling them, making them realize, you know, that book that I said I was reading by Tim Ferriss, right? He quotes Chris Sacca, S-A-C-C-A, who's like a venture capitalist or whatever. And he talks about in the summer holidays when he was young, his dad would like use his connections to get him like a job like with a high-powered attorney or like some kind of white-collar job. And then for 2 weeks, and then he would get another contact that he had, like his brother-in-law or something. This guy, Chris, would then have to spend straight after 2 weeks basically like hauling out muck and doing like the dirtiest jobs and stuff. And of course, the thing you realize is, I want that kind of job and not that kind of job.
Well, indeed. You have... What else is there going on? So the people in the room, so it's not just me making up the digital detox. Right. There's a group of meeting of people who are differently minded to me, and they wanted to limit gaming to 1 hour per day for the pupils, on, not at weekends, but on weekdays. Mm-hmm. And I was against that, really. I just thought, look, we already control most of their time. And what they do with the time that they can find is up to them, really.
And what do you think their parents would do, though?
I don't know, but their parents aren't there. I mean, we are in loco parentis, but they wouldn't live a life like the life they live if they were at home with their parents. So their parents, some parents would do different things. Some would monitor, some would curb it, some would squash it altogether. But in a boarding house, you know, so they get there at school from 8:30 till 5:00 mostly. Except for a bit of time at lunch. Then they have 2 hour break, which we fill with activities at some points in the week, but not at others. So we do like after school clubs and those things. CCF is run, no, not CCF, DV is running that time, other things like that. Then they get, and they have supper at 7:00, and then prep starts at 7:30 until 9:00, and then the year nines go to bed at 9:30 or 9:45. So they have very little window to do what they want other than that 5 to 7 time, which is when the hour would be. And I think, well, if that's an hour, if it's 2 hours, that's not that big a deal, personally, especially when we're taking up some of that time anyway with other stuff. So I just thought you're putting these locks on, which are just going, people are just going to resent, and there's actually not that much bonus coming out of it. But some people are very concerned about the amount of gaming in their boarding houses, so that's kind of where that comes from. So I'm not sure where that's going to end yet. And then there's
many variables there as well, like the personality and the age of them, and the what, you know, you mentioned on one of the previous podcasts that one of the kids you dealt with had a very locked down kind of life at home, and any kind of chink of ability to self-determine what he was doing with his time at school, he was just
in the sweet shop kind of thing,
glutting himself on
no, that's right. I think that's true. And but so then the last thing, which I don't know whether I'm going to do yet or not, but this is a digital so it's not called digital detox anymore, it's called digital health and the whole program. And then I want to do a digital hiatus in it. So I want to do, I think, a whole week of every pupil not having their phones, that's all the way up to the 18-year-olds, and all Wi-Fi in the school, internet within the school being switched off except for access to email and our intranet. Mm-hmm. And then all lessons in that week would be taught analog. So they would be without using computers, that sort of thing. So the purpose of
the important thing there is, are the adults doing the same thing?
Yes. So the teachers as well.
Okay.
But the teachers can't have their phones. We can't control their phones. So the purpose of that is to help people to reflect on the positive use of technology as well as the negative use of it. The benefits that technology, the things that you've really missed about the technology, is it just the entertainment? Is it the access to TV? Is it what blah, blah, blah? Yeah. Or is it that you've been frustrated in the work that you're doing as a teacher and as a pupil, that you're not able to look things up and you're not able to cross-reference information, et cetera, et cetera. So I want them to do that. And someone suggested, if we're going to do that, then we should also do the flip of that, which is the school must go paperless for a week. So there should be nothing but digital classrooms going on, kind of, not, you know, in relatively speaking. Obviously, the lessons will still take place, but then people are encouraged not to exchange bits of paper as work, but to exchange electronic articles instead, digital articles instead. Artifacts, sorry. And so I thought that, so that's an interesting thing. So I have to make a decision about that, whether that's a good thing to do. I would do it in the warmer months, but well before exam season, so that people have good alternatives to get outside and do work in a different way. Yeah. And just things are lighter and brighter come spring.
I don't think this is true of teachers, because teachers work crazy hours and, you know, that don't have to fill in time. But you know, people who have, you know, we did that thing about Dave Graeber's idea of bullshit jobs. I do feel like the idea of the kind of rise of the bullshit job has gone hand in hand with the rise of the smartphone. And just, you know, there was another study which said something along the lines of people who, instead of doing a 40-hour work week, did a 32-hour work week, so effectively 4 days, and had a day off, got as much work done. I think that's, for most jobs, like office-based jobs or whatever, that's obvious, because you don't have to pad out your days anymore. You can just get the work done.
Oh, gosh, I had this really, I don't know if I should talk about this online. I won't mention the name of the company. I had this really interesting conversation with a guy who was married to a former matron of one of the boarding houses. And he works for one of the world's largest investment banks, right? Mm-hmm. So we were talking, I snuck away to have a cigarette, actually, and he came and joined me. So we were chatting, and I never introduced myself as the head of digital strategy. I just say I'm a computer science teacher. So he started talking about tech and what was going on at his bank. The conversation started off crudely with that he's one of the last six people that wear a suit at work, and he doesn't wear a tie any longer, and that kind of thing. And everyone's just coming very casually to work in this bank. But then he went on to say that the word most used in their offices is agile. And they have Facebook and Google as customers, and they're looking to emulate their working practices to become like them as companies. So they're becoming like tech companies, teaching everybody in their organization to code. So that's where kind of the story came in, if you know what I mean, you know, what we're doing at GCSE, computer science, they are doing with all of their bankers, but also all of their secretaries, so that the secretaries are able to understand the email communication and what's required, etc. They understand the language, and so they're teaching them to actually code to do this.
This is the removal of white collar jobs as well. You know, people talk about, oh, automation, getting rid of blue collar jobs, but actually, those jobs where you're just an interface between two other things might actually, or even making decisions. Sometimes algorithms or whatever might make better decisions than you.
It was interesting. We came to the conclusion, the work that my A-level students are doing, the standard of the work that they're doing, that they could walk into a six-figure salary job tomorrow.
Wow.
Sort of the seniors, you know, the upper six who are leaving the school, the stuff that they're, how they're working is just incredibly advanced. And that's fair, to be honest. So one of our students left last year, and he works nights for Monzo, you know,
the bank. Yeah.
Global bank, if you like. While he's doing his first year of computer science at UCL, I think he's at. He's been earning money through computers for years and years now, to be fair. But interesting.
I'm not going to be able to find the link, but someone was talking about, really, the thing that allows you to earn money at the higher levels in this day and age is emotional intelligence. Like, you can have all the skills, and I've come across many people in my time who have got all the skills, and I'm not saying that I'm particularly emotionally intelligent, although I think I've calmed down a lot over my career, and I'm not so controversial, and I listen to people a bit more. But you can have all the skills, and maybe that's one of the advantages of a school like yours, Di, the fact that not only do kids come out with, you know, good grades and skills and stuff, but they're also potentially emotionally mature and have the skills to be able to deal in that kind of environment.
Yes, yes. No, that's an important thing. And we do, yeah, I don't know if they are or not. It's the proof's in the pudding, I guess. But it's interesting. I mean, things are certainly changing out there, aren't they? They're certainly getting different and people need to respond to them. And I do go back to the idea of computational literacy, which we've spoken about before. Mm. And I don't think that everybody needs to know how to code, although I do think so many jobs now require you to be able to crunch large data sets and to meaningfully interpret that data. Sorry if that's really noisy. So just so people know, I'm sitting on this outside this house, recording on a Surface Pro, without any microphone or anything like that, and buses and things keep driving by. it's crap.
Let's move on from Don Norman, because I want to give an example, just riffing off what you've just talked about there, because I sometimes wonder, you know, the kind of work that I do, am I liable to be outsourced or could an algorithm do my job? And some of the complexity of the stuff that I've had to deal with recently and like decisions I've had to make and thinking differently, it's not a linear thing. Like you can't, machine learning is all about taking patterns that have gone before. There's a great Invisibilia article about our podcast episode about this, about patterns in people's life and whether they can feed forward. Machine learning is all about taking big data sets and looking at what's gone before and then making predictions on what could happen in the future. But of course, if you want to do something different, or if you want to think differently, then it's quite like machines aren't particularly good at doing that. So I'm not saying that I can't be replaced by a machine, but I would say that the kind of the product manager role that I've got, is quite a complex thing, I'd say.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. I think teaching is the same.
It is, yeah.
You can talk about this and that and the other, but I do think the most important part of teaching comes down to the relationships between teachers and pupils. Often those relationships are poor. That's a really unfair thing to say. When you think of bad education, those relationships, people don't take enough time and place enough emphasis on them, I don't think. And some people might say it's not about that. It's about the relationship with the pupil, the material, and things like that. But I'd say the most important factor in influencing education is that relationship.
Yeah, definitely. And there's that kind of glib quote where people say, oh, you know, any teacher that can be replaced by a machine should be. But there is some truth in that, in the sense of, like, if you are just doing that kind of thing that you've been talking about there, of just providing content or teaching to the test and not doing anything else, not spending time getting to know pupils, etc., then absolutely, maybe kids should be sat down in front of Khan Academy or Duolingo or whatever. Mm. But I think that anything which involves human to human emotional understanding, interaction, development, and growth does can't be replaced by machines, but probably shouldn't be.
Yeah, so thinking about that and thinking about sort of more didactic methods. Is that I don't have anything against them, because I think when you see really good didactic teachers who kind of have this lecturing style, I don't have a problem with that. I just think I have a problem with that being all that a child gets in a day. But that is what's happening there. So what happens is the person through charisma and knowledge becomes the sort of fishing net, if you like, for the pupils and their understanding. And I don't think it's a touchy-feely thing. I think it's about good, straight, honest connections between two human beings, and that can be completely centered around the content. And so, for example, in the didactic model, I once watched a 40 years of experienced historian teaching, and the way that he adeptly went around the room checking the children's notes as he talked and marking them for intervention. You need to add more here. You need to put this in here, as he went in a kind of really quiet sideway, but as never losing the narrative of what was going on around the top of the class through his voice and things like that. It was very skillfully done. And all of those children felt engaged and held to account in their learning as well. It was, you know, lots of really good things. Those relationships were there without question. A very popular teacher, you know. Interesting stuff.
No, absolutely, absolutely. These things are extremely complex. And of course, you're always going to have people who are, you know, reductionist and think that, oh, well, you know, all you're doing is doing this. But those people don't. Right. So just an example of, this is going to sound very simple, but I just want to use it as an example of how you have problems and like engineers and techies would solve that in a particular way. And then you have to try and think differently for different people. Right. So here we go. You may have seen that on Mastodon and Twitter, I've got three emojis next to my Twitter and Mastodon name. And I've got my name on there, and I've got three symbols. And I did that a while ago because I just wanted to have a bit of flair next to my name. And the three symbols I've got are the European Union flag, because it was at the time of Brexit, a skull and crossbones to show that, you know, I don't really care about the way things are, and I'm happy to do new things, including copyrights, and not really caring about that. And also like a raised fist in terms of like fighting the man. And some of these are aspirational. Like if you looked at my life and you know, you'd probably think it was quite conservative, but this is how I see myself and how I'd like to aspire to. Anyway, so there's this, I guess what you could call an emoji triplet. There's three different emojis that I'm using to try and describe myself. And I used this in a workshop that I ran at the Mountain Mood. I was like, if you had to describe yourself in three emojis, which ones would you use and why? And it was actually quite revealing and a really good starter kind of activity. And it got me thinking, on any kind of social network, you can usually change your avatar and your username. On some social networks, you can't change your username. Like once you've said it. So for example, and some, they have bizarre kind of things where on Twitter, I'm verified on Twitter. If I changed my username on Twitter, I would lose my verified status. It's only verified for that username. So I was thinking, okay, we're going to be making MoodleNet. MoodleNet is going to be decentralized, just like Mastodon. So that means that you could be on any different instance, etc., and you could change your avatar and you could change your username. How would somebody know that that person is still the same person? And I thought, well, what we could do is, there's a technical way of doing that. Like you could technically prove, like blockchain or something, like you could prove that that person technically is the same person, but how could you do it in a human friendly way? And it took me back to this emoji triplet idea, and I thought, well, if everyone had a unique emoji triplet, okay, you wouldn't memorize everyone's emoji triplet, but in the same way that when I use my deterministic password manager, LastPass, if I type in my password in a way that just goes dot 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 or asterisk 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 so I can't see it, I can still tell that I've, and this is in the article, I can still tell that I've typed in the right password, because when I type in the correct password, it comes up with the right emoji triplet. And I, if you asked me, Doug, when you type in your master password, what are the exact icons? What are the exact emojis which show up? I would kind of not be able to remember. But I know what they are when I see them. In the same way, I think that if you looked at my profile a lot and it had that European flag and the pirate flag and the raised fist, and then you took that away and you showed me with a different emoji triplet, you'd know that one was different. And I that's what I'm trying to get to. I'm trying to just get to that kind of human level of trust and a decentralized network, if that makes any sense.
No, I get it. I'm just doing mine right now.
What are you choosing? Yeah.
So I've gone for sunshine, rain, and bare feet.
Very good.
That's kind of my thing. So it's quite difficult to choose, though. When I saw you'd done that, right, on the thing, it's a difficult thing to choose. And I thought, he's chosen a pirate. What's that all about? Pirate's about stealing money and treasure and rape and pillage and stuff. Nasty. But I get what you do, pirate radio, and then
It's more like it's not accepting the social order the way it is.
Exactly, which is indeed where piracy possibly originated, and certainly is in a certain aspect now. And so, what was the other one? What was the third one you did?
Like a raised fist, like fight the power.
Yes, yeah, fight the powers that be. I thought that was all important. I thought maybe isn't that too prescriptive? Like, or it's too one-sided of you. Aren't you more complicated than that?
I am, but the idea in this particular context for MoodleNet is that you don't actually get to choose your own. You're just given a random triplet.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, so I'm kind of riffing off this idea that I just randomly had, and then thinking, can you remember ages ago we talked about that service called What Three Words, where you could use three words to describe and then pinpoint anywhere in the world, even that didn't have like maps or whatever. Not maps, what I mean, postcodes.
All right, okay, yeah.
So this basically, by using three words, you can narrow things down to I don't know, 10 by 10 square meter place on the world. And I thought, well, if you could describe anyone in the world with three words, maybe you can describe anyone on a social network using three emoji. And it's going to be like, when you go to sign up, this is what we're thinking at the moment, I'm prototyping it with Outlandish. When you go to sign up, you're given like three random emoji. Now, it might be that the first emoji in there is going to be the same for everyone on the same instance, for example. Another two kind of then demarcate who you are. I'm not sure. But the idea is that you don't get to choose your emoji, because then there's going to be people who are fighting over emoji and whatever. It's just you're given three random ones. And if you don't like it, then you can just refresh the page and get three different ones.
Just regenerate.
But you can't change them after you've signed up.
Oh, okay. Well, that sounds like a very, very simple and straightforward method of doing it, because in the same way you have recaptures now, where identifying images, I guess, is computers can't pick that up. Or could they pick the code of that up? I don't know. I'm guessing they can't, because LastPass are using it.
Well, the LastPass thing is different. The LastPass thing is just to show that you don't have to memorize everyone's kind of emoji triplet to know whether something's right or not. Mm-hmm. Like, in the same way that when you do a spot the difference puzzle, you know that one of them's slightly off.
Yes.
Actually, this takes me into, this is quite a kind of me geeking out a bit here, but there's a link I've just put in here called Minimalistic Blogs. And I mentioned this to Brian Mathers. Hi, Brian, if you're listening. And he has actually kind of taken this and run with it. So I came across in early July, I came across these two things on the same day. And the first one is called Itty Bitty Site. And the second one is Blot. So Blot is just the kind of blog that you might have seen before, where you add files to a Dropbox folder and it's kind of content agnostic. And it just basically creates a blog out of stuff that you put into a Dropbox folder, which is great. The other one, though, is much more interesting. So Itty Bitty Site, if you go there, and you know when you have a really, really long URL, like you might get on a Google Doc?
Yeah.
That's just making sure that that is a unique URL and can't be guessed by anybody.
It is.
But on this website, the URL actually contains all of the information that's then displayed on the web page.
On which website? An Itty Bitty site? I'm off.
So basically, because the web page only contains text and emoji, and emoji obviously take a very small amount of space because they're in Unicode, you can define the entire web page just using the URL itself, because it's base64 encoded.
Okay. Itty bitty things can be conveyed in a link. Type here and then share. Hello world. Oh, okay, right, I see. Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, different browsers on mobile and on desktop allow like a different amount of payload to be in the URL, like a different amount of content to be in there. So like Firefox pretty much allows you unlimited, but some like Safari only allows you, I don't know, a certain amount of like kilobytes or whatever it is. And for me, like, it's such a simple idea, but it's fantastic. So Brian's actually taken this. I can't remember the link for his remixer. But if you imagine a page where it's got different elements and you're basically just configuring elements in like a very simple web app, the URL that you then use to share tells the website on how to then configure all the elements within the page so that it doesn't have to be very big at all. And it just has such great potential for doing links that don't have to then reference any other site in terms of downloading stuff or whatever. And also for if you're designing badges or anything else. It's got so many applications. It really has. And if you're listening to this, you're going, what on earth is Doug talking about? Just go to the site. It's itty.bitty.site and read what's there. And after a while, after going through it, you'll kind of get it.
Yeah, no, it is. I just created a quick little web page and sent it out on Twitter.
Right. Very cool.
I like. Cool. All right. Brilliant. That's quite inventive. I quite like that.
Like someone's made a calculator on there, and it's just entirely contained within the URL. So I thought that was very cool. Anyway.
Yeah. It is very cool. I like it. Itty bitty sites. Okay.
So, you know, sometimes when you write stuff or you share things and you're not always sure which things are going to resonate with people. This particular one called On Living in Public, where I quote Austin Kleon, who also quotes somebody else, Warren Ellis, whose newsletter I subscribe to. This one seemed to resonate with people, and people were sharing it on Mastodon and Twitter and elsewhere. It seemed to kind of resonate. And it's just basically saying that how different things are in 2018 from how they are in 2013. I don't know if you saw this one.
No, I haven't seen this one.
So let's just go through it quickly. So Austin Kleon wrote a book. So I got his calendar on my wall, and it's great. He does he does kind of newspaper blackout art where he'll have a newspaper article and then black out all the words apart from certain ones, and then he'll cut them out and stuff. Yeah. And he had a book in 2013 called Show Your Work. And he says, it seems ridiculous to say, but in 2013, the year I wrote the book, it was a simpler time. Social media seemed much more benign to me. Back then, the worst I felt social media did was waste your time. Now, the worst social media does is cripple democracy and ruin your soul. End of quote. And then he quotes Warren Ellis, who, if you don't subscribe to his newsletter, which is called Orbital Operations, you really should. It's fantastic. So Warren Ellis kind of is known for writing Marvel comics and getting involved in Netflix series and stuff. So, but he lives like by himself, like a hermit, apart from going to like a couple of conferences a year. And his
estuary, isn't it something?
Yeah, the Thames is basically Southend-on-Sea. Thames Estuary, he calls it. And Austin Kleon quotes Warren Ellis. Do you want to read that one?
You don't have to live.
Yes.
Okay, so you don't have to live in public on the internet if you don't want to, even if you're a public figure or micro famous like me. I don't follow anyone on my public Instagram account. No shade on those who follow me there. I'm glad you give me your time, but I need to be in my own space to get my shit done. You want to hack for handling the internet? Create private social media accounts, follow who you want, and sit back and let your bespoke media channels flow to you. These are tools, not requirements. Don't let them make you miserable. Tune them until they bring you pleasure.
I just thought that was great. I mean,
I think that's absolutely right. And I tried to do that with lists. So I use Hootsuite for my Twitter stuff. And I have different searches on there. That allow me, so when a hashtag comes along that interests me and I want to follow it for a little while, I will create a new stream, a new column with that hashtag only, so I can make sure I bring my attention back to it over the coming weeks and delete it when I think I've had my fill. And then I have lists that I've created that I specifically follow so that I can keep up on things really quickly that I want over, usually over a cigarette in my life. But
I think this all feeds into the way that social media, and it's difficult sometimes, it's like boiling the frog sometimes when you've grown up with the web or grown up with social media, it's hard to realize that it has changed over the, you know, 10 odd years that we've been on there. I came across a post I've just put in here, and I put this on Thought Shrapnel today, and the author of this was imagining LinkedIn being like a massive multiplayer online role-playing game, MMORPG. So mm-hmm. It's as if it's a game. He's imagining LinkedIn as a game. And I just thought this was by turns kind of hilarious and also kind of instructive of how just ridiculous LinkedIn is. I'm just going to read the quote that just starts off. It's quite a lengthy one. He says, for those unfamiliar, LinkedIn is a 2D turn-based MMORPG that sets itself apart from its competitors by placing players not in a fantasy world of orcs and goblins, but in the treacherous world of business. Players can choose from dozens of character classes, e.g. entrepreneurs, social media mavens, finance wizards, each with their own skill sets and special moves, power lunch, signal boost, invoice dodge. They gain experience by networking, obtaining endorsements from other users, and posting inspirational quotes from Elon Musk. The general goal of LinkedIn, the game, is to find and connect with as many people on LinkedIn, the website, as possible, in order to secure vaguely defined social capital and potentially further one's career, which allows the player to purchase consumer goods of gradually increasing quality. Like many games, it has dubious real-life utility. The site's popularity and success, like that of many social networks, depends heavily on obfuscating this fact. This illusion of importance creates a sense of naive trust amongst its users. This makes it easy to exploit. End of quote.
I think that's it's really good fun. The idea of gaming LinkedIn and basically going around the back. And it reminded me, as you were reading that, of when I started playing video games, computer games with my own children. And they got to a certain age and they started getting hacks that you can put into them to get like all the weapons or to be invincible or whatever. And my reaction to that was, you're not engaging with the game in the way that it was intended. And therefore, the game has lost its draw, its attractiveness. And I don't want to play. And I remember thinking that, but also taking from it a lesson, because it's the last time I really played computer games, because my children just got better at them, essentially, than I did. And I couldn't put enough time into them. But it's interesting in that it's not a big deal to people who've grown up with the internet, like misrepresenting yourself, like sort of recommending here to do on LinkedIn by following people that work for massive companies like Microsoft or Google or whatever. And you'll get followed back by them and your sort of link, which is exactly what I did when I became a Google certified teacher on LinkedIn, I connected with all the Googlers that I had met, and some of them connected back with me, and it looked like I had a job there. It sort of looked like I work for Google. And I think that must misrepresent to somebody, which is often the majority, does not understand exactly what's going on. It misrepresents who you are and what you are to them, and has a distorted influence.
Absolutely. People are always looking for, you know, to make themselves look more important and have connections and whatever. I just thought it was great. I just love the way that it's, just saw LinkedIn as a game. Interestingly, when you're talking about hacks there, I was just sitting there the other night thinking, hang on a minute. I've got a NVIDIA Shield in my living room, which is basically Android. Get emulated for Android. Surely I can get every single Super Nintendo and like PlayStation, like original PlayStation game. Sure, I can get like all of them on that NVIDIA Shield. So I spent a couple of hours. And I've now got lots of Super Nintendo games, especially on my NVIDIA Shield via this quite complex emulator. But like you say, they've all got cheats now. Like every possible cheat is now out for those. So when you play the game, you get to choose, do you want to play it normally or do you want to like turn on all the cheats so you can't die, you know, infinite lives, whatever you want to do, which actually is great.
Well, that's the point. It can like serve a purpose, and you don't have to be limited by these things. So, for example, if you take I don't know, chess. You say you're playing a game of chess. Imagine if you could like have hacks for a game of chess, and you could be wearing a kind of, you know, a pair of glasses that would instantly lay out different moves that you can make and the possible next 10 implication moves, possible, whatever, whatever combination. Do you know what I mean? The things that chess players do where they're anticipating each line of moves and potential implications of the next move. That kind of thing. I mean, it'd be quite cool, a good sort of educative game. It'd help you become a better player for when you did play hackless and things like that, when you got the
rules. It's like Minecraft. Minecraft has creative mode, and it has, what's the other mode?
I don't know.
The other mode, the one where you die. But in creative mode, you don't die. So you can basically learn, it's like a sandbox. And then I think Fortnite's just put that in as well, hasn't it? Like you can have it used to just have Battle Royale, but now you can have a sandbox where you can learn your skills with your friends. And I think anything like that's extremely useful.
So. Yeah, so I was teaching Minecraft on Raspberry Pis in my classroom before the end of the end of the summer term, and I got these great hacks where you could build like a house, so you could just run, you built it in Python, and then you just ran it. We were just nicking the code and sticking it on the thing, and then people were starting to pimp the code. As you understood it, so you had this code that created a castle, I think it was. But to create the castle, they had to remodify the land and the whole world. And so then they learned how to remodify half land, and then they would just go into a game and slap the land down. So if you'd initiated the game, you got other people to join in, and all of a sudden you could just run the code that would just change the landscape entirely, or cut half the world away, or something like that. And things like that. So it's quite complicated code, but once you sort of started to understand it, you started to unpick it, and you know, you could build it's like you can do hacks in Minecraft where you build a you automatically have a block around yourself of air, so that means you can walk through every wall, you can just keep walking through everything because
okay, you are, but this is, I mean, without this is a serious point, but you know what I mean, like my concern is that when you are in front of a device that isn't locked down like iOS or whatever, and you've got some skills like yourself and the students you're teaching computer science, you get used to setting things up exactly as you want, and any problem can be solved with code. And then, you know, I see this especially, and we've talked about this before, in kind of engineer's mindset of, well, we just fixed it, and it's very difficult to then explain how human beings are messy, and that solution, that very neat solution, Elon Musk, that you've just suggested to rescue some people from a cave, might not work. And actually, it's going to rely on kind of human ingenuity as opposed to like brute force engineering.
I didn't read much about that cave rescue, which was a sort of remarkable affair, but far overreported. But Elon Musk got into trouble for calling one of the British divers a pedo. Is that right? Something like that.
Elon Musk has a fragile ego. He was complaining about people calling him a billionaire, which is literally just a descriptive term. He said that, oh, people only call me billionaire when they disagree with me. Whatever. We should probably choose a couple more and then wrap things up. What kind of grabs you? What grabs you from the rest?
Okay. Well, I just want to bring attention for anyone listening that might use Microsoft OneNote and Google Classroom. So this is from the TCEA blog, which is something to do with Miguel Gulin, whom you've spoke of before, and some 10 questions put to Microsoft, and one of them is, can I link OneNote with Google Classroom? And the answer is, now you can. So you can sign into Google Classroom through OneNote or something, or the other way around. I don't know. So you can share your OneNotes with Google Classroom, so you can share them with your lesson, your lessons.
Is this a recent thing?
The post was published only this month, so I'm thinking so.
Well, it's interesting. I'm going to put something in here again, which I wasn't going to mention this week, just in case we came to it next week. But so Google, Facebook, Twitter, and Microsoft have announced a new data transfer initiative. So I put a post in here called like data transfer as a hedge. Now I can't help but be skeptical about this, but it would seem that because Google has been fined in the region of 5 billion euros by the EU.
4.6.
Pardon?
4.6 billion euros.
So they're 4.6 billion euros in an antitrust case because basically they're forcing different carriers to bundle Google Chrome in the same way that, you know, back in the day, users were forced to use Microsoft Internet Explorer when they used Windows.
No, it's not just Chrome. It's more interesting than that. So I watched the woman. So there's, I can't remember the name of the woman. I watched her speaking on a BBC article. So it's to do with Android and it's to do with search. So basically, Google developed Android to make sure, so everybody who uses Android has to allow Google search to be the default undeletable, unswitchable search engine for that phone. And Chrome is also in it, but it's not the main driver, it's the search. Oh,
okay. Well, yeah, that's interesting because Google bought Android, didn't they? And then developed the open source technology, the stuff on top of the open source technology.
Yeah.
So this particular thing, so thank you for that. This particular thing is, in the wake of all that, I think some of these people are thinking, oh, actually, we're going to have to allow some interoperability, otherwise the game's up, and we're going to get, you know, fined a lot of money. And so the example is, the kind of mocked up example, is somebody using the equivalent of Google Takeout to put their photos from Google, signing into their Microsoft account, and then putting them into OneDrive. And the adapter, they're basically going to take proprietary APIs into an interoperable transfer, making Instagram data workable in Flickr and vice versa. Now, that sounds great. And there's actually nothing in the articles which suggest, and in the white papers and the demos and stuff, which suggests otherwise. But I can't help but think, given the people involved, they're going to make it so that the incumbents, like, you know, the Instagrams of this world, et cetera, Facebook, will be able to pipe data between very easily. But if you're a new startup, just like Twitter have announced this week that they're changing their APIs, if you're a new startup, you're not going to get a slice of this pie. I don't think that it's going to be so easy for you to be able to, you know, users to take their data from Facebook and put it into your new little startup.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. So it's going to make the market more impenetrable. And what this, so the GDPR still sits as the greatest regulation, as this 4.6 billion euro fine shows, sits as the greatest regulation or the greatest set of legislation that is going on to hold the large tech corps to account in some way, shape or form. And it really is leading the way by the EU, and very well done. But this is their response to that. This is like, well, let's unite forces and batten down the hatches.
Yeah,
I think. Sort of thing. So whereas, as Google won their way in the world, which is through user-centric design, not dissimilar to what we were discussing earlier in the is it Donald Norman article, you have these companies. So Google, yeah. So the convenience of the user is always going to win. And so the fact that you can put all of your data, push it through one service to another, and you don't have to stick with one, because people like the variety, they like choice, they like to stick with their tools. The fact that you can now hook another service in means that interoperability becomes seamless or much, much better. And the user will be happier, and the user will...
I've argued years ago that interoperability is inevitable, and that open source always wins, but it just never feels like that. Like, for example, people talking for years about this is going to be the year of Linux on the desktop. And of course, it'll never be the year of Linux on the desktop. But for example, Linux underpins all the servers. It's the core of Chromebooks, which now can run Linux apps natively. Like, you win in different ways. And I think this kind of interoperability between systems isn't Mastodon or anything like that, but it does allow that kind of user sovereignty, which is a good thing. Just as a last link I thought I'd put in here, I've been wary of using only something like Lineage OS, which is the new version of CyanogenMod, to replace the operating system on my Android phone. Because what happens is that you don't get Google Play services, which means that a lot of apps don't work, even if they don't actually really need it. So they'll just say, oh, Google Play services isn't here, so we're not playing ball. And there's this project called MicroG, and I haven't flashed this onto my main phone because apparently there are a couple of security potentials, you know, very esoteric security concerns, but I have flashed it onto my NVIDIA Shield tablet and onto my spare phone, which is a OnePlus One, and it runs really well. And the reason for that is it basically spoofs the connection to Google servers for like location and stuff and replaces it with like Mozilla's location service. And anytime it says that it needs Google Play services, it just pretends that it's got it and everything seems to be fine.
Okay, so far so good.
Yeah, so basically the MicroG project, you can get a version with OS with MicroG built in. So you just download that thing, flash onto your phone and you're off. And so if you have that and you have FDroid, which is the open source repository, and you have from the FDroid repository an app called Yalp, which is Y-A-L-P, you can download APKs, which are basically the files, the apps from the Google Play Store, using like a generic account without ever having to sign in. So some people listening might think, why would you ever do that? But you know, as Google get more of a grip on your life, it might be you either have to succumb to the all-embracing God that is Google, or just resist. And I think that it's good to resist sometimes.
No, I think it will. I think that is interesting, and I'll be interested to see what it's like when it's on your OnePlus 5. And because I think that is important in relevance to all of this. So because of that, I've just put in here a link in the show notes, the BBC article on Google, on the Google Find, which is $4.3 billion, I apologize.
Okay.
But it has an interview in there with the lady who did the thing, and I thoroughly recommend that you watch that, Doug, because she also talked about app repositories. Her name is Margreth Vestager. So I recommend watching that because she also talks about the app stores. She talks about when there's any alternative. So there's no reason, for example, if you are Amazon, she uses that. Watch it and you'll see. It's an interesting thing because it's about the app store lock-in as well.
Okay, so in that article, it says that the three ways that Google's acted illegally required Android handset and tablet manufacturers to pre-install the Google Search app and its own web browser Chrome as a condition for allowing them to offer access to its Play App Store.
Yeah,
it made payments to large manufacturers and mobile network operators that agreed to exclusively pre-install the Google Search app on their devices, and it prevented manufacturers from selling any smart devices powered by alternative forked versions of Android by threatening to refuse them permission to pre-install its apps. So, you know, for example, if companies said, oh, well, we're going to install like Lineage OS instead of, you know, the official version of Android. And all of these shady practices are the reason, one of the many reasons that Firefox OS failed.
Yes, absolutely. And she is identifying these and she's leading the way. So so anyone listening to this at the end of this podcast, I do recommend going and having a look. She needs our support is what I would argue.
No, definitely.
One last thing to mention is a colleague of mine tweeted out that the fabulous comedian Stuart Lee, I think, has a 2-hour show being screened on BBC Two on the 25th of July, which, gosh, that's today. Or maybe that was, well, it's on Saturday, I think. Anyway, it's going to be on BBC Two and then on the iPlayer afterwards. Stuart Lee is doing it. He's a very, very funny man.
Okay.
I recommend to watch.
Well, I watched one of his shows. I hadn't really seen him before, but I saw him on iPlayer and he was talking about different things on a theme. And he was good talking about autobiographies and all that kind of stuff. And just a very, very cleverly put together show. So yeah.
Good stuff. Yes. He is good fun. And if you want a real laugh, I think So I don't know what you think of Top Gear, Doug, but I'm not a big fan of the old Top Gear presenters of Clarkson, Hammond, and May. And anyway, he does. If you look on YouTube for Stuart Lee and Top Gear, you will see one of the most brutal bits of comedy you have ever seen, and it is hilarious. But some people can't take it. But I recommend going to watch that.
Okay. Cool. Okay. So you're in Idaho for next week. We might be able to sneak another tide in, I think, before I go on holiday.
Okay. Yeah. So I can do during the day. That's not a problem to me. It's nice to talk to you. And
okay. So over the next week, you're just going to be sampling the delights of Idaho a bit more?
I am. Yeah, absolutely. A bit of camping, good live music. I'm going to see some bluegrass, which is awesome. I'm looking forward to that.
Very good. I am finishing off we're doing some work with Outlandish around kind of the UX work following the design sprint. And so things like that little emoji ID and lots of like a million decisions have to be made, and they've been fantastic. So we're finishing that this week. And then it's a summer holiday. So my kids have been at like holiday camps and whatever. Next week, they're at an athletics one. And then, yeah, I'll talk more about my holiday next week if we do Tide. But yeah, preparing for that, which is interrailing around Europe with the family for 2 weeks. But hopefully we'll get a chance to talk either next Tuesday or Wednesday.
Cool. If not, I'd like to hear more about what is it that your co-op has chosen not to go to open something next year?
Should I talk about that now briefly?
You want to? Yeah, it's an interesting
thing. So right now in London, it's the Open 2018 conference. And this is exactly the kind of conference that our co-op would go to, because it's about platform cooperativism. So what we're used to, or talking about all those big companies we've just been mentioning, is platform capitalism. And the way that those work is you create a platform, people use it, Amazon, Twitter, whatever, and a small bunch of people make a lot of money from the fact that those users are using it. So Uber is a perfect example of this. You've got taxi drivers, et cetera, creating value for a small bunch of venture capitalists who are making lots of money. Platform cooperativism is where the users of the platform own the platform itself. Social.coop, which is the Mastodon instance I'm on, is kind of an example, a small example of that, in that we own that platform. If you had the equivalent of Uber, but where all of the taxi drivers own the platform and therefore share in their success, that would be a platform co-op. And platform cooperativism is seen as kind of the future and the way that we get beyond late stage capitalism, basically. So lots of tech co-ops and people who are thinking about this kind of stuff go to this conference. And I think it was the first one last year, or maybe it was the second one. Anyway, at this event, which we, you know, greatly enjoyed, apart from this particular episode, we met fantastic people from Outlandish there, et cetera. And we're part of this wider cooperative technologist network. But there was the shadow home secretary or the deputy prime minister at the time, John McDonnell, was there, as was this academic. And this academic had obviously, you know, known John McDonnell back in the day. And Laura Hilliger was on that panel, a member of our co-op, and she is an expert on kind of helping, like crowdsourcing and collaboration and community organizing and all that kind of stuff. And the panel was set up talking about how to crowdsource the next Labour manifesto. But this panel was hijacked by this academic who just wanted to talk about his own work and the relationship between him and John McDonnell back in the day. And at one point, Laura was, you know, not only patronized, but was basically told to read the questions from the sheet, when she was actually, you know, supposed to be there for her expertise. And it got so bad that at the end, I decided that, you know, I was going to say something. And so I stood up and almost shaking with anger, mentioned that, you know, can we now hear from the expert on this field rather than what you did in the 1980s? And the organizers of this, who are lovely in their own right, but don't get diversity issues in tech, just didn't seem to see particularly what the problem was. There was a vague apology, but it was nowhere near kind of fitting. And so this year, the start of this year, they asked if we'd be interested in helping with Open 2018. And Laura responded in a very dignified way, saying that yes, and we'd be happy to help with kind of more inclusion and diversity issues. To which they were like, oh, I'm not sure if we've got a budget for that. And in fact, they wanted us to work for free on it because they basically hadn't got a revenue model. So the conference is happening today, which is Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. There'll be some awesome people there, but like we're effectively boycotting it because we don't think that it's the kind of place that is representative of the entire co-op movement.
Wow. Well, I think that's well done for standing up in the first instance. And I'm sorry to hear that on Laura's behalf, if you're listening, Laura. That's awful. But well done for standing up.
Well, it's not me, and I don't do, as if you talk to Laura, I do not do enough in this regard. But I do kind of sometimes slightly roll my eyes at some of the lengths that people do go to, especially on social media around diversity. But maybe that's because I'm a privileged middle-aged white guy who, you know, is playing life on the easiest difficulty setting, as people constantly remind me.
I'm winning. Well, yes, but still, you stood up at the thing, and that's what I mean by you standing up. But for the cooperative for not participating in an event that you generally see as good on a point of principle, you know, it's not often you see that. Mm. Cool work, I think.
Well, at the end of the days, you can't take any of it with you, and if you haven't served for your values, then you've got nothing.
Mm-hmm.
There we are. Cool. Well, on that bombshell.
Well, I will see you on my hot porch. I will see you next Tuesday, unless something else happens.
Okay. Well, that's been Tide 105. Thank you very much for listening, everybody. And I hope that you're keeping cool or warm, depending where you are in the world. Goodbye.
Take care.
Watching the tide roll away. Ooh, sitting on a darker bay, wasting time.